Welcome back one and all to another episode here at the Damage Report with me, John Itarola, and a special treat joining us once again, Charles Coleman Jr. Charles, how's it going?
John, what's going on? It's such a good feeling to be back. Glad to be here and thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. It's great to have you here anytime. We are, of course, in the middle of two very high profile court cases. So I imagine you've probably been pretty busy recently, huh?
Yes, there's been a lot going on between Cal Rittenhouse and the McMichael brothers, who are on trial with a third individual in Brunswick, Georgia, for the death of Ahmaud Arbery. I refuse to call this the Ahmaud Arbery trial because I'm a big person on narrative control, and Ahmaud Arbery didn't do anything. The only thing Ahmaud Arbery did was get killed for being unarmed. And essentially looking to know what was going on in his neighborhood and checking out an empty house in Brunswick, Georgia. So I won't refer to it as the Ahmaud Arbery trial, but those two trials have kept me extremely busy with a lot going on and a lot developing, especially in the Rittenhouse trial, where there was a huge day yesterday after he took the stand.
Yeah, 100%. And we're going to be talking a lot about the Rittenhouse trial. On the trial of those who killed Ahmaud Arbery, and I totally agree with you about how we should phrase that. I'm sure I've done the opposite way, unfortunately. What have you thought so far about what you've seen?
Well, I think the biggest thing about what is going on in Brunswick is race as the 13th juror, as I like to say. I think that race has been obvious to those of us who can't ignore it, and those of us who can have tried their best to act as though it's not an ever-present factor in what we're seeing. For example, it took forever, like literally over a week, for them to get a jury in this case. Why? Because they wanted to have black people who are represented in the case, but they didn't want the black people who were represented to have authentically black experiences, meaning that they didn't want them to be tainted by racial discrimination or bigotry or any of the things that, quite frankly, have become to be a part of the DNA of what it is to be American and live in the South. And so I thought that was a very interesting sort of narrative to examine about what it was that you were using to preclude jurors in terms of their own experiences with discrimination, but then also sort of not being willing to acknowledge, unfortunately, for better or for worse, and really just for worse, that's a significant part of what it is to experience blackness in America. And so you can't really separate the two. And so I found that to be very, very interesting. We have 11 jurors, I mean, we have 11 white jurors and one black in that case. I am not overly optimistic about those 12 people doing the right thing all together in that case. And I think here's where my experience as a former prosecutor sort of taints my vision. In a lot of ways, my concern is around the fact that, you know, it takes an unanimous jury to secure a conviction in a criminal trial of this nature, a unanimous jury. That means all 12 have to agree beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
Given the challenges that we have already seen around the jury pool, I'm not necessarily convinced that Brunswick, Georgia has 12 people that at the same time will come to that space at that time around these facts. And so I am significantly concerned about the notion of a mistrial or a hung jury. I won't say a mistrial. I don't necessarily know that that would be an issue, but certainly a hung jury is something that I think we could see. It would be very, very, I'm using this word, usually pleasing for me from a judicial standpoint to see a verdict, to see a guilty verdict, and to allow that to take shape and form. But I don't know that we're guaranteed that by any stretch of the imagination. And so I am watching this trial very, very intently because the racial dynamics of the group that are hearing the facts and determining the facts in this case have me extremely concerned.
Yeah. Well, you know, we will definitely be following that. And you know, some of my more meta concerns about that case also apply to the Rittenhouse case. So we'll be talking about that in just a little bit. But thank you for being here. And for those of you watching, regardless of what platform you're on, we appreciate you being here as well. Please don't forget to hit the like button and share the stream if you haven't already. We are going to be talking about a lot over the course of the next 90 minutes, including Kyle Rittenhouse, how the right is trying to frame this entire case, the book burnings that are coming, Ted Cruz's assertion that Rhodes can't be racist. We will actually look at the facts in that case. We've got Satan in Target. Why not? He's everywhere else. And more besides. So don't go anywhere. Stay tuned. We got a lot to talk about. But with that, why don't we jump into a little bit on the other big case as we launch into this video.
Deep breath, pal.
So in that small excerpt of a much longer period of crying, you saw Kyle Rittenhouse, who is on trial for multiple killings right now. And so on this little panel that we have for our show, you have me. I'm not a legal expert. I'm a million miles away from it. I'm just a guy who watches what is happening, is very worried about the entire context and narrative of this case. Thankfully, we do have a legal expert who's on with us, Charles Coleman. So when you saw the crying and the fact that the judge sort of broke for a period and then eventually did a 10-minute recess, the judge even offered Rittenhouse a bottle of water. What did you make of that crying?
Well, of the crying itself, this was scripted preparation by his defense attorney. Listen, from a technical standpoint, I think that the testimony and the manner in which that Rittenhouse has testified from a technical standpoint purely has been extremely brilliant. Like, it's been a case study in terms of, if I'm a defense attorney and I want to get my client acquitted, this is what you got to do. At the end of the day, whether you believe the theatrics around Rittenhouse's performance yesterday, and I'm going to refer to it as a performance, that really doesn't matter. What matters is, did the jury buy it? Right. And I think that we had, you know, he cried on cue, and then right on cue, his mom cried. And the jury was there to witness that. I think that the important thing that viewers need to remember, and I talked about this previously about the Brunswick trial, was the fact that all they need is one or two jurors who were affected by that to have sympathy for Kyle Rittenhouse in a way that makes them feel like there's no way that this was not self-defense. That's all they need. And then Kyle Rittenhouse walks free. They're aware of that. It's a lot easier for them. And the justice system is designed this way. You are innocent until proven guilty. And so if they don't prove to 12 people beyond a reasonable doubt, everyone who's sitting in that box, that those tears were false and that Rittenhouse essentially had this in his head when he went to Kenosha and crossed state lines illegally with an AR-15 at 17 years of age. You know, they've still got a very high burden, because their burden in most cases is around proving that Rittenhouse is the actor. Mm-hmm. That's the hard part in most cases. In this case, the burden is around proving that Rittenhouse had a particular state of mind. This is not a whodunit. They know that Rittenhouse went to Kenosha. They know that Rittenhouse had the gun. They know that Rittenhouse pulled the trigger. He hasn't denied these things. So in terms of frame of mind, they've got an uphill battle. And yesterday's testimony made it more challenging, because despite what me, you, and other viewers may think, or what I may think rather, there were some people who were affected by that. And part of the reasons, and I talked about this previously, is the fact that Kyle Rittenhouse enjoys the privilege of being able to be viewed as a 17-year-old white male teenager. Yeah. And I think that we have to confront that. We have to discuss it. We have to explore that. If Kyle Rittenhouse were Kyrie Richardson, and he went from Newark, New Jersey to Brooklyn, New York with an AR-15 to protect Brooklyn neighborhoods in the middle of a Black Lives Matter rally or protest, let me tell you what wouldn't happen, okay? He wouldn't have been able to walk by law enforcement with an AR-15 wrapped around his neck, wave to them, and them give him the thumbs up and good job. That's number one, okay? Number two, he wouldn't be able to walk through the streets, kill someone, or kill multiple people after shooting people and be apprehended by law enforcement that he actually walked by after doing that, and this not be a problem. He wouldn't be able to be apprehended without being seen as a dangerous threat after he did that. That's number two. Number three, he would not be on trial enjoying the cloak of white nationalism support, gun lobby support, and everything else that he's been able to enjoy from the very far right that has wanted to herald this young man as some like young Bruce Wayne vigilante who was standing up for his community and standing up against thugs and rioters. So yeah, we've seen that narrative from the media. We've seen that narrative play out in terms of certain branches of the country in terms of how they feel and view Kyle Rittenhouse. And it's playing to his advantage right now. And they knew that. And you know, to some degree, I suspect in no short order that the judge in this case also sort of believes that narrative, because despite the fact that I have agreed with him on some of his rulings, overall, he has shown an incredibly deep bias toward the defense side. And I would have to think that it has to do with something of how Kyle Rittenhouse is being portrayed as a 17-year-old young man who wanted to do the right thing. That narrative, people have actually bought into. So people will have bought into the tears because it confirms what it is that they want to believe about who he is.
Yeah, totally. And look, so since we have you here, there's a few things I hope that we can get through that I want to better understand. I will start with the tears though. So supposedly, if it has an effect on someone, presumably the effect is it lets us know what he thinks about this entire thing. I would say bringing the AR-15 also tells us a little bit about what he thinks about the world. He's being presented as someone who just wanted to help. And they're ignoring the gun, which is weird because when I go to like volunteer at the Humane Society, they don't want me to bring my AR-15. They don't get why that's just a part of being a good kid and all that. It's so weird how that works out. But okay, so there's a couple legal things that I want to understand that like, the people who are saying this is just self-defense, take it as a given that the law is the way it is for good reasons and not to allow certain types of behavior and not others. So there's a few things that I don't understand. So one is he was being pursued by people after shooting and killing a person. So he's being pursued because they're pursuing him. He gets to say he's scared for his life. And so presumably he might be able to kill them and that's fine. So what I want to understand is if a kid's in a high school and a school shooter comes in and the school shooter has a gun and he walks up to a group of kids and the kids throw books at him, does he get to shoot them? If he shoots the first kid and then other kids try to tackle him and begin beating him, is he allowed to then murder all of the rest of them? Like, I don't understand the stripping away of the context of what he had already done before the later shootings happened.
Sure, it's interesting that you bring that up.
Really fast, let me finish. Mm-hmm. Is there no requirement for you to have an understanding of the situation you are creating by going there and bringing certain types of weapons? Does that have nothing to do with whether what you eventually end up doing is self-defense or not?
No, what you are talking about is a very important point that is actually at the center of both of these trials in a lot of ways. Can you or should you be able to claim self-defense when you are the provocateur, when you have provoked, when you are the initial aggressor? And that is generally speaking going to be something that varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But there are many jurisdictions that even as the initial aggressor will allow you to claim self-defense if there is a reasonable belief that you are in threat or danger of imminent loss of your life or serious bodily harm. It seems backwards, but it's the same conversation in Brunswick. You went and chased this young man down. You were armed. He was not. There were three of you. there was one of him. So you are outnumbered and outgunned. You know, factually, I think that question is even more apparent in that case than it is in the Rittenhouse case. In the Rittenhouse case, you have this, you know, attack with the skateboard, and you know, the problem is that part of the prosecution's case has been about hurting its own case, as far as I'm concerned. They've put up witnesses in Kenosha who have undermined and undercut the overall strength of their case through their testimony. Now, for what it's worth, I appreciate them being honest on the stand. They've acknowledged, yes, I had a gun. Yes, I essentially waved my gun at Kyle Rittenhouse, or was under the course of the law, basically menacing Kyle Rittenhouse with my gun. Those things all give credence to Kyle Rittenhouse's story, at least for one of the shootings. And so this notion of self-defense, it becomes something that is more viable, unfortunately, by the own testimony, by the admissions from some of the prosecution's own witnesses. So that doesn't help his case anymore. But what you're talking about is a very strong legal question that comes up all the time. Am I, as the aggressor in a situation, allowed to then argue that I acted in self-defense? Yeah. And it's usually going to be based on the facts. But again, I want to point out the demographics here, the identity politics here. Kyle Rittenhouse is a 17-year-old, or being viewed as a 17-year-old white teenage, you know, sort of superhero in training by a lot of people. And that is cloaking his actions in the minds of a number of people. And I think that the defense, they're expecting that to be the case. And the more I think about his testimony yesterday, when he said, I wanted an AR-15 because I thought they looked cool. Initially, I thought that was a snafu. I sort of kind of cringed when he said it. But the more I've thought about that, strategically, it only reinforces the narrative of, hey, this is a kid. I even remember hearing testimony from one of the victims who was shot, who described his fake tears as someone, he said it was like a child who had gotten caught, who had done something wrong that they weren't supposed to do, and they weren't upset because they did it, that they, what they did was wrong. They were upset because they got caught. This infantilizing of Kyle Rittenhouse and this sort of like intentional keeping him in this teenage box, whether it's consciously by his counsel or subconsciously by, you know, the way that this narrative has been spun in media and everywhere else, is making it even more challenging to convict him of what he's done wrong. So, you know, there are a lot of factors running against him. But to answer your question, John, that whole like, I started this, but now I want to claim self-defense thing is a real problem when you talk about the self-defense doctrine and how it can be used.
I definitely agree. Okay, we only have a couple of minutes, but I have one other question for you. So one thing that seems to tie together a lot of these cases, potentially Kyle Rittenhouse, when he says they were lunging for my gun at one point, the case of those who killed Ahmaud Arbery, when they bring a shotgun and then say that he's grabbing at the shotgun, Zimmerman as well, is they sort of seem to need to prove that they were in danger, not just of being beaten, but of being killed. And generally, the people that they end up killing are not armed. So to make the case that, you know, that Trayvon Martin was going to literally kill me with his bare hands is a little bit of a tough case to make, potentially. So they bring a deadly weapon to within arm's reach of a person, and then they can claim that because that gun is there and might be taken from them, they are then in threat, like the threat of death.
Yes.
And so Ahmaud Arbery, nobody thinks he's going to, what, did he watch a lot of Bruce Lee movies growing up? He's going to kill three men with his bare hands. But no, now there's a shotgun nearby. Ignore the fact that I put it there and that it never needed to be there. I never needed to be there. In all of these cases, none of them needed to be anywhere near where they're at. They went there and they brought the gun that then serves as not just the tool for the murder, but the justification for the murder as well. This seems very see-through. Is this something that is talked about in cases like this?
It is, of course it is, John. But I think that you have to sort of, you got to consider the logic that people in certain places use, particularly around guns, particularly in places where guns, you know, are sort of readily available and it's not a big deal around owning a firearm or the type of firearm that you own for protection. Their motto, like many of the Second Amendment buffs, are, look, guns don't kill people, people kill people. So their argument is the mere presence of the weapon itself should not evoke any sort of concern around deadly harm being done. It's just simply there for protection. But when someone who I'm in conflict with attempts to reach for that gun, now I have a reasonable fear for my life because we're in conflict. But if left alone, that gun should not evoke any sort of like concern for that person. I don't think it's very logical. I do understand that from a legal perspective, they have a very small ground to stand on, but it's not something that I particularly like. And we're seeing how problematic it is as it plays out, kind of sort of in a different way in both trials.
Yeah. Say that the system seems to be set up to produce this outcome. And if he does end up walking, well, why wouldn't he just do this again? The next time there's a disturbance, why wouldn't he just go and bring a big gun and get close to people? And if they come near you, why not? Like, I know that justice is about, like, these cases are about these individual cases, but they're also, I think, about sending a signal to the country about what behaviors we want to incentivize and which we do not. And it seems pretty clear, and it'll be even more clear in a minute when we get to the right-wing media reaction, that they want more of these situations. Because we can't even get these people to say, okay, he was doing self-defense, but I really wish he hadn't been there. I really hope that nobody does this. We can't even get them to say that. They can't even say that he made any bad choices in this. He was just a good kid. But we'll get to that in a minute. We are gonna take a quick break, but stick around. We got a little bit more on this when we come back. Okay. Sorry, I just saw your note. No, we're gonna be moving on to the B block. Yeah, those videos were mostly if we needed them, and it turned out we didn't. Okay, so unfortunately, prepare yourself because we're about to turn to the right wing. So in the Kyle Rittenhouse case, you have the actual case and what's happening there, and then you have how this will be interpreted by the country. What are we as a society going to take away from this? What are we gonna learn, if anything? Well, the right is pretty clear on what they want you to think about vigilantes like Kyle Rittenhouse. Here is Jeanine Pirro. She seems maybe a little bit biased.
You've got a young guy who was a new CPR. He was a police explorer. He was some kind of fireman cadet. He was a good kid. He went there to clean up the graffiti on the buildings. The bottom line here is that this kid has established that when he shot Rosenbaum, the first victim, he was in fear of for his own life. When he shot the second guy, Huber, he was in fear legitimately and reasonably of his own life. And when he shot Grosskreutz, the third guy who didn't die, for which he's being charged with attempted murder, he had legitimate grounds for which to use deadly physical force.
Exactly. I mean, he's just a good kid. You know, he's like a lifeguard. Like, for instance, if he sees that someone is drowning, he'll do a few warning shots in the air. And if he sees any graffiti, what's the easiest way to get graffiti out? Well, if you shoot the wall to bits, the graffiti won't be there anymore. So you just tear up the wall and get all the graffiti off there. And you know, he's a good kid. He also killed several people and doesn't really seem to have learned anything from that. But Charles, so right off the bat, there's like very little acknowledgement, if any, that he broke multiple laws. Whether he in the end gets to say this was self-defense, he broke multiple laws. They don't care about that. It's perfectly fine. His motivations can't be impeached. He was just there to help. And by the way, he proved that he was in fear of his life. This vague thing that can't be proven, a prior psychology of a person. I would love to ask, so when he raised his gun to shoot Rosenbaum, if Rosenbaum had been holding a gun and had shot Kyle Rittenhouse, presumably Rosenbaum was doing self-defense. And if any of the others had successfully shot him, presumably they were doing self-defense. Or if an onlooker saw him gunning down people that successfully shot him, they can prove that they were doing it for self-defense because a guy with an AR-15 was literally going around killing multiple people. But we've talked about self-defense. Now it's the right cannot even acknowledge legitimate concerns about whether he should have been there, why he brought an illegal gun in the first place. It's just, he's a good kid. And I assume They will always address kids regardless of race. It's just, they're just good kids, you know? Why are you being so hard on them?
Yeah, so in a way that most people might not understand, Jeanine Pirro's comments and approach is extremely problematic and deeply, deeply triggering. And I know that we are sort of having this conversation about Kyle Rittenhouse, but I talked about the politics of identity earlier, but this strikes at the heart of it. What we know statistically, because it's been proven, is that Black and Latino males in America are oftentimes viewed and assessed between, in their teenage years, between 1.5 and as many as 3 years older than they are. That leads to a very different type of interaction with law enforcement. It leads to a very different type of treatment in schools, and it leads to a very different type of assessment in the courtroom when they are sentenced for crimes. And so what Jeanine Pirro did was essentially show you how that works in action. Let me sort of remind viewers of something about that network, about that ideology, and about those political leanings. Trayvon Martin was 17 years old when he was killed by George Zimmerman. He was a 17-year-old teenage male. When he was 17 and he was killed, and George Zimmerman was on trial, and George Zimmerman was the one who was facing charges, the conversation was about, should Trayvon Martin have had on a hoodie? Had Trayvon Martin smoked marijuana? Was Trayvon Martin wrong for having used racial epithets to describe white people? These were the conversations in different attempts. They talked about Trayvon Martin's grades in order to criminalize Trayvon Martin. Now, no one is talking about the fact that Jeanine Pirro seems to conveniently leave out the fact that Kyle Rittenhouse was walking around in a bar at 17 years of age, which is legal if you're with an adult. He was 18 at the time, which is legal if you're with an adult in his part of the country, with a shirt that said free as you know what. She's not talking about that. She's not talking about the fact that there was testimony and evidence that did not come in about Kyle Rittenhouse's history in terms of beating up young women and violence there. Yet there is this almost angelic picture of him painted as this damn near Boy Scout. He was training as an EMT in a fire. Not he lied on the stand. Not he was in illegal possession of a firearm. And Pirro is someone who can be called to task for this because she is a judge and knows better.
That's crazy that she's a judge.
And so the idea that this has taken place and that this is the narrative, it's not a new one. It's not something that we haven't seen before. However, it is insulting and deeply, deeply triggering.
Yeah. Look, there's a little bit of objection to this on some mild points that Geraldo is going to bring up, and then they go back and forth. Let's show you a little bit more from that video.
He's a dopey kid with a hero complex. You know, he shouldn't have been there, shouldn't have had the AR-15 on the street and all the rest of it. But I think he walks, I tell you the truth. I don't see how they touch him on the murder cases, the most serious charges. The other one, recklessly endangering. I think there's a reasonable possibility that aside from the possession of the weapon as a minor, I think that the Rittenhouse is going to go.
Go ahead, Judge.
Well, first of all, I don't think he's a dopey kid. Just because he isn't Mr. Cool from New York City doesn't make him a dopey kid. Okay, this kid practiced CPR trained. He was a police explorer. He was a fire
cadet. He's a 17-year-old guy.
You know what? What should
AR-15
he be doing?
To a neighboring
you know
state?
What? You don't know what it's like in that part of the country, and maybe you do.
I do. I live
you
there.
You do. You live there. Okay. It's a part of life for them. And you know what? The charge is for possession of that weapon, 9 months, because he's under 18.
I think that's
so
the only one they've got.
Let's not conflate the issues here. That's a good kid. That is a kind of kid who can grow up and have a moral core.
Okay, he went somewhere with a gun that he never should have had. And she's all about law and order and all that. Doesn't care at all that he broke that law. Bah, it's only a 9-month thing. Does she just casually go to jail for 9 months at a time? It's no big deal. I personally think that'd be pretty significant if I was sent to jail for 9 months. But no, he will get away with this. And you also can't even say that he shouldn't have done it, that he shouldn't have broken the law, that he shouldn't have been there, that he idolized having weapons of war on the streets. You can't even get that out of this situation, Janine Pirro.
I find it so interesting that there are these strong defenses of Kyle Rittenhouse coming from the right. And you know, many of them are rooted in Second Amendment lore. Quietly, they are rooted in anti-blackness, in as much as the part of the narrative that a lot of people are not talking about is this false belief that part of why he needed to be there was because Black Lives Matter people were tearing stuff up. And that's what we were seeing around the country. That's not been explored, right? Like, you know, that's not been a part of the discussion, but it is part of what fuels the sentiment. The part of the sentiment, you know, and you saw it with the judge who talked about, well, I won't allow the deceased to be referred to as victims, but I will allow them to be referred to as rioters and looters, right? Like, so there's this like really strong sentiment of like, well, maybe they're Antifa, maybe they're BLM, maybe they're problematic on certain levels or what have you, but he was doing us a good thing. He was doing us a service because he has such a strong moral core. And it, you know, it's insulting. It is racially coded if you are paying attention, because even though his victims were white, let's be very clear, they were all out in response to the shooting of a Black man.
Yep.
And so that has played out over and over again. And I think that there's a lot to be said about that. And I can't help but to parallel how many times, you know, Philando Castile comes to mind. We're talking about Wisconsin. He's in Minnesota. I understand that. But how many times have we witnessed, and I can think of others, John Crawford III, and others, who where we have cases of Black people who were armed. Actually, John Crawford had an air gun. He didn't have an actual gun. Who were armed lawfully, did not use their weapons, and ultimately paid the ultimate sacrifice of their life with law enforcement. And I realize this isn't a police case in that sense. But what I'm saying is how we are conditioned to view one person who has a gun versus another person who has a gun. And with Janine Pirro saying, well, you don't know what it's like. It's a way of life out there. Why is it a way of life only for white people when they are able to carry guns?
Yeah. Yeah, I hadn't remembered her name, but I remembered the case. So it's Marissa Alexander had fired a warning shot, and it wasn't ruled as admissible as standing your ground. Like, she literally, she could have shot the guy. She chose not to.
She literally gave you a warning.
You don't get to.
She literally gave you a warning.
Yeah.
That, hey, I don't want to do this, but you know, please don't provoke me. And that's what happened.
Yeah, it's if a Black woman warns us of it, it is 1,000 times worse than a white male doing it somehow. That's America. And in Florida, by the way, which you can do stand your ground for pretty much anything, assuming you're not a Black woman. Okay. I like our audience too much to make them watch these videos of Tucker Carlson and JD Vance today. So we're gonna move on to other. Oh, by the way, the rest of the news is terrible too. But at least it's about something else. So we're gonna move on to this. The right-wing media has a few core principles: one, that schools shouldn't be safe spaces; two, that cancel culture is running amok; and three, they want to get rid of every book in schools because they're personally offensive to them and they don't like it and they don't want to see it. So this has been going on all over the country. In Virginia, in Texas, they had a list of over 850 books that they don't think your kids should be able to read. Screw your parental rights, not you, only them. And now we have this. Specifically in Virginia, the Spotsylvania County School Board has directed staff to begin removing books that contain quote unquote sexually explicit material from library shelves and report on the number of books that have been removed at a special called meeting next week. Specifically, there were these books in the LGBTQIA section that like a parent had a problem with. So your kids don't get to read those now. The criteria for pulling books from circulation this week is sexually explicit, but the board plans to refine how material is determined to be objectionable for a further review of library holdings. To give you an idea of what this is about, because this might seem on its surface to be kind of censorious, they want to make sure that you understand that it is. So the Cortland representative and board member, Rabi Abu Ismail, said, "I think we should throw those books in a fire." Livingston Representative Twigg said he wants to, quote, "see the books before we burn them so we can identify within our community that we are eradicating this bad stuff." And I had always sort of thought that if you're gonna like launch this sort of like Christian fascist campaign, like just don't do the most obvious Nazi things. Like don't use a swastika. That's just making it too obvious. Don't literally burn the books. These are very minor bars. So easy to get past. You could do all sorts of censorship and whatever without doing that. They couldn't pass the don't burn the books test. And so if you're in this area, some books that might help to broaden the horizons of your kids, help them to understand different communities, maybe help them to understand themselves a little bit better. Nope, your kids don't get to read those in school if some other person had a problem with it. What do you think, Charles?
John, I have a lot to say about this. And I think some of the viewers who are watching may not necessarily make certain connections. So this is happening in Virginia. And we just saw a significant Democratic loss in the gubernatorial race in Virginia. There is a connection here. And I want to be very clear. First and foremost, from a strategic space, I actually am kind of impressed that they figured out a way so easily to really push back against what they believe is a LGBTQA plus queer agenda that's attacking their kids in schools by labeling it porn. Just call it porn, call it pornography. Yep. We'll push it back, right? I was like, oh wow, that's immediately gonna get people on their side if they aren't already. That's pretty impressive. But I'm sure this was months in the making. But there's a larger story here, and I want to make it plain for viewers. One of the reasons why the gubernatorial race was lost in Virginia by Democrats was because of Loudoun County and what happened in Loudoun County as from voters. Why did Loudoun County go from a county that went for Biden just a year ago by over 10 points to a county that was much, much, much closer for Republicans? Well, it was related to, in no small part, an incident that occurred at a Loudoun County school where there was a sexual assault by a young woman, by a female student, by a male. And the male claimed to be transgender, and that's why they were in the same bathroom, and that's why it happened. And then the school caught fire because, and this was reported in the New York Times, this is not a secret, it was in the Washington Post as well. The school caught fire because they essentially hid what happened from parents and did not tell people what happened. There was a school board meeting where parents actually went to jail because they were that angry and incensed about the fact that they didn't know that this had happened, and they didn't like the fact that they had these transgender bathrooms at this school. Well, the Youngland campaign seized on that, and that's when this conversation about we're going to make it okay for you to tell us what you want taught in schools, regardless of whether you have any background in education or not. And ultimately, we're seeing that play out in real time with this. This can all be traced back to the incident that I just described, which had a significant impact on the outcome of that race and is now taking hold in terms of what people are trying to keep in and out of classrooms in Virginia. And so this actually has to be a message to progressives and to Democrats to figure out, where do we draw the line, or where's the line drawn in terms of how we negotiate this whole notion around school curriculum and choice, and unfortunately this boogeyman of CRT, because it is being weaponized against us in ways that are deeply problematic and longstanding for years to come.
I agree. I mean, look, if I was on the right and if I had no interest whatsoever in putting together some sort of positive agenda that would address the economic issues of our country, I would definitely be culling, I would be searching the country for something to pluck up and then use as an excuse for doing literally anything I want. You made the connection. The connection, they would make that same connection between that sexual assault and this. Is there any logical connection between those two things? Like having that book there, is it a cause of sexual assaults? Of course not. Do I like that the right has finally found a sexual assault that they do care about? They finally found a woman who they believe? Yes, on some level. But I also know that this has very little to do with any of those things. Monmouth University just did a poll and they found that 46% of Republicans disapprove of teachers educating students on the history of racism. That is actually what they were asked. Not CRT or whatever, just should we teach about the history of racism in this country? Almost half said no, we should not. You should not know anything about race massacres or when, you know, the decades and decades long history of lynching, or when black politicians would win local office and a white mob would come in and kill literally every single person there. You should not know about that. They are explicitly pro ignorance, hiding the truth from their kids. And they will hide all of this behind supposed parental rights that they should get to choose. Well, if you want your kids to learn about the history of racism, if you want them to read Beloved or The Handmaid's Tale or 33 Snowfish or whatever, no, you don't have those parental rights. The censors do. And I would sort of understand that. I mean, after all, this has been a party that for a very long time has cozied up to right wing Christians and those sorts of things. But they also will then switch to, we're against cancel culture and safe spaces. We don't believe in censoring things. Why is the left always censoring? Why are you canceling things you don't agree with? Oh, are these things not politically correct? Well, they found a whole bunch of things that they don't think are politically correct and they want to ban them as a result of that. So I know the hypocrisy doesn't matter in this country. It's just expected that you'll be fundamentally hypocritical about every one of your supposed values. But there sure is a gap between what they say they support and what they're doing every day in these school districts. Any final thoughts before we go to break?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that part of the reason why people don't want this stuff taught is because you have to realize and understand that it's not just history. When you look at what we're still dealing with today, any student, any logical person, anyone with half a brain is going to wonder, well, if this is history, why are we still dealing with it? And I think that that's really what's driving the right and driving this movement against teaching actual history in schools. They don't want people to discover it's not just history, it's actually our present.
Exactly, exactly. And you've been making that point in some of these cases, like a lot of what we're seeing from the judges, the way the laws are set up, these are not, well, I was gonna say they're not relics of Jim Crow. I guess in some ways they are. They're not Jim Crow, they're right now. Yeah. And still having effects. You're totally right there. Okay, we are going to, you know what? Actually, we're gonna demonstrate that principle. We're gonna take a break, but then we're gonna come back. We're talking about infrastructure, some of the historic discrimination infrastructure that's still going on to this day. We'll be back. Okay, Charles, you ready to talk about something truly spicy? Are you ready to talk about infrastructure? It's gonna be fun, don't worry. Oh, I think you might be muted, Charles.
Let's get it on, John. Okay, let's awesome. Get it on.
Okay, let's do it. And we're gonna start off with one of my favorite people. Joe Manchin might, oh my God, he might have a problem with Build Back Better, but no, I heard he was definitely gonna support it like a week ago. I think, didn't Biden get a promise? I don't know, because now Joe Manchin is saying, I don't know, inflation. He tweeted, by all accounts, the threat posed by record inflation to the American people is not transitory and is instead getting worse. From the grocery store to the gas pump, Americans know the inflation tax is real and DC can no longer ignore the economic pain Americans feel every day. And I love that tweet so much, not only because I'm sure some of the moderates were hoping that like they would just tone it down for a little bit and then kill it in a month or something. He didn't wait more than a week. But what I love about that is he's saying, I'm not gonna do anything because the American people are hurting. He's saying we can't ignore the economic pain while advocating for literally not doing anything to help with the economic pain. I don't know how much I consider him a particularly clever man, but I think that's a clever little ironic point to make. Let's ignore you while claiming the reason we should ignore you is because DC has been ignoring you. So anyway, Charles, it might not happen. If it does happen, it ain't happening this year apparently, and it might not happen at all.
Listen, you and your racist Rhodes can sit down until next year for all I'm concerned. Joe Manchin is doing what Joe Manchin does. And at the end of the day, my issue is not with Joe Manchin. My issue is with the other Joe in Washington, Joe Biden. And I say that because our government is not designed for any one person to hold us by the proverbial balls. But the way that Democrats and Joe Biden have navigated this Joe Manchin situation has created a situation where it's just that, where he's doing just that. And so from my honest assessment, shame on you, shame on Chuck Schumer, shame on all of you all from a leadership space where you've cultivated this space where this one guy who was not necessarily, and I get it, like I get numbers, I get all of that, but that's when you're strategic. That's when you figure out other ways to solve the problem that don't allow the way that the wind blows on a particular day and how Joe Manchin wakes up and what side of the bed he's on to dictate whether you get a multi-billion dollar bill passed that's a key piece of your legislative agenda. Why would you leave that up to one person? And if you did, why don't you have a strategy for dealing with it? So I actually don't blame Joe Manchin for doing what Joe Manchin does. This is actually the real reenactment of the story of the tortoise and the scorpion. If you know that story, the tortoise carries the scorpion. Like Joe Manchin is the scorpion. And I don't know why you're acting as though you don't know this. You knew it. You knew, you know, to quote, there's a football quote from Danny Green. He is who we thought he was. Yeah. And it's just like, you got to accept.
Exactly. It's his nature. Well, the reference you made before, though, to the racist roads, is a ridiculous thing that Ted Cruz said. So Pete Buttigieg has pointed out that infrastructure is not racially neutral. Choosing where you spend money, how you spend money, how different groups get affected by the money you spend also matters. So we want to just briefly talk about this as a reminder of as we engage in all this infrastructure spending, we do have to understand how core racial justice should be to this money. So Mayor Pete had pointed out that some highway construction had negative effects in certain communities, which led Ted Cruz to tweet, "The roads are racist. We must get rid of roads," because he's a very serious person who cares about his constituents. Sorry, his white conservative constituents in Texas. Well, it is racially discriminatory though, because the US interstate highway system, which was built from largely the 1950s to the 1990s, more than 1 million people were forced from their homes, many black neighborhoods entirely bulldozed and replaced with those highways. And in areas where it would affect largely black communities, they bulldozed. In areas where it was white communities, they generally didn't do as much of that. That was very common. It was explicit. Some city leaders in the mid-1950s saw the interstates as a good opportunity to, quote, get rid of the local N-word town, a former top transportation lobbyist later recalled. It was convenient to them. And the thing is, more recently, these highways have been widened. And who do you think is being displaced from that? More than 200,000 people have lost their homes nationwide to federal road projects over the last three decades. It's actually way higher than that. We don't know the real number, but that's what we have. And that is still going on. You can see it in Houston in 2008. There wasn't nearly as much expansion in white areas, but this is not just history. It is history, Ted Cruz, but it's not just history. And so when we spend all this money, if we ever get it, let's try to be a little bit more understanding of who's being affected and in what way. What do you think, Charles?
You know, unfortunately, I'm not able to stay for the whole program, but this couldn't be a better way for me to walk out. This is exactly why you need to teach history, because then you don't have to worry about people making up narratives which don't make sense and are ahistorical. But what I will say about Ted Cruz is this. I find it interesting that he has as much vitriol for racist roads, for Big Bird, for everyone else than he does the one guy who called his wife ugly, who he has yet to stand up to. So off all this Texas tough talk, I'm not buying it until Ted Cruz has something to say about the guy who calls his wife ugly. And that's what I've got to say about that. It's always a pleasure. Sorry I have to jump, but love being here and look forward to coming back.
It's great. Always great to have you here. A great point. It's almost as if he's saying all this stuff about Big Bird so that he doesn't have to actually like account for who he is, what he's done, and what he has not done. Very good point. Charles Coleman, always great to have you on. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, John.
And have a good day. For those of you at home, we do have more news coming to you. So if you're on Twitch, YouTube, or the members app, more news is coming. We're gonna take a short break, but don't go anywhere. Lots of great stuff coming up after this.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.